I thanked a lot of people yesterday, but let me again thank Oxford University and the Philosophy Department and All Souls and Brace Nose for inviting me to give these lectures and hosting so hospitably. And thank you all for coming, and for many of you for coming again. It's wonderful to have a big group of people all together able to do philosophy with. As I said yesterday, these lectures are intended to be self-standing and intelligible, each one on their own, and I hope also of interest, each one on their own. But for those who want to connect yesterday's lecture to today's, in yesterday's lecture, I raised the question, what is it to be distinctively human? I did not answer it, but I did argue that it would be an unsatisfactory response to identify being human with being a rational agent. And then I further speculated that the tendency to emphasize rational agency in thinking about what was especially important or even essential to us led us to impoverished or inadequate conceptions of a number of other ideas that are central to philosophical thought about who and what we are. So though I won't refer any further to yesterday's lecture, you could see today's lecture as an illustration of that second point, in particular with regard to the concept of responsibility. So, the word responsibility has a wide range of uses in a wide range of contexts. In one common use, to be responsible for something is roughly equivalent to being the cause of it. Thus, an avalanche or an infestation of beetles or a cigarette left smoldering on a trail may be responsible for a clump of dead trees. Good weather, good news, or a visit from a friend may be responsible for one's cheerful mood. This causal use of the term is often contrasted with another, and as it might be thought, deeper sense of responsibility that's intended when one wants to identify not only the cause of an event, but the individuals, if there are any, who deserve blame or credit for it. Whose role, in other words, in bringing the event about might make punishment or reward, condemnation or gratitude appropriate. The contrast between these two broad uses of responsibility is often marked with the labels of causal and moral responsibility, for the most obvious illustrations of the distinction are ones in which it is the legitimacy or appropriateness of moral judgments and attitudes that are at issue. One would not blame an avalanche or even a horde of beetles for killing the trees. They do not deserve punishment, nor would indignation toward them be appropriate. If a camper carelessly dropped a cigarette that started a forest fire that killed the trees, on the other hand, that would be another story. Similarly, it seems, one would not give credit to the sunshine for one's good mood, but if someone had gone out of her way to cheer you up, a certain kind of gratitude or praise might be appropriate. Philosophical interest in what is typically called moral responsibility also has a wide range of sources and is linked to a correspondingly wide range of issues. Since moral praise and especially moral blame have serious consequences, it's a matter of practical importance to know when and under what conditions the relevant moral judgments and attitudes are deserved. A less obviously practical but still clearly philosophical reason for being interested in this kind of responsibility, though, is the thought that such responsibility is somehow connected with what makes us distinctively human. For it seems that humans, and only humans, at least among the creatures with whom we are currently in contact, can be appropriate bearers of the kind of attitudes and judgments we might have towards the careless camper as opposed to the beetles. And it is not unreasonable to think that this reflects something important about ourselves. It's this sort of interest, an interest that is in the connection between our status as responsible agents and what sets us apart from other animals and at least present-day machines, that leads me to the topic of this lecture. For I suspect that the tendency to identify the sense of responsibility that might be illuminating for this purpose with specifically moral responsibility leads us to or reinforces a tendency to overemphasize certain aspects of our psychologies and to neglect the importance of others. For this reason, I want to look at what appear to be instances of responsibility that are akin to moral responsibility in being more than and deeper than causal responsibility, but that are connected with judgments and attitudes that are not particularly or essentially moral. I want specifically to look at a range of phenomena that suggests that there is such a thing as aesthetic responsibility. By aesthetic responsibility, I mean to refer to a kind of deep but non-moral responsibility that an artist may have for the aesthetic qualities of his or her artworks. That there is such a thing is suggested by several kinds of experience. Consider the following examples. You have a friend who's an aspiring painter whose work is largely non-representational. You walk into his studio one day and are struck by a canvas still on the easel. You are inclined to think it is the best thing he has ever done. But before you get around beyond your initial wow, he says, "Oh, that's just a mistake. I knocked some paint cans over on the canvas and haven't gotten around to cleaning them off yet." Or suppose that you read a short story that impresses you for its ability to succeed on two levels. Read straight, it has an interesting plot, decent characters, and a sensible message. But certain details call to mind a Greek legend that allowed you to interpret it also as a wry commentary on an ancient tale. The protagonist is named Penelope, let's say, and the story concerns her way of handling some overly aggressive suitors. Now, imagine your reaction when you discover that the parallels to Homer are purely accidental. In fact, the author has never heard of the Odyssey, and she named her heroine after Penelope Cruz. In both cases, as I understand them, you're initially inclined to credit the artist, but reasonably withdraw your credit upon learning that the qualities in the art you admired were merely accidental. Although the artist in each case remains causally responsible for the artwork, he spilled the paint after all, and she wrote the story, neither are aesthetically responsible for the qualities that made you initially admire the art. The fact that in these examples we find it natural to withdraw credit highlights the fact that in more typical cases, we give credit. Other things equal, we take it for granted that the features of an artwork that make it good, that is, that make it beautiful, interesting, moving, insightful, and so on, are due to the artist. They are not independent of the artist's aesthetic vision and skill. But my interest in aesthetic responsibility is not restricted to the question of whether artists deserve credit or its opposite for the aesthetic qualities of their artworks. At least as important is the appropriateness of a range of judgments and attitudes that are not solely or primarily evaluative. Most of us, when we respond to art, do not just judge it on a scale of aesthetic excellence, insofar as we do this at all. We like some art, some music, some novels, more than others. And in many cases, the way we feel about the art gives rise to, or perhaps is inseparable from, feelings or attitudes towards the artist. I love Henry James, but not James Joyce. Matisse, but not Picasso. Even though I readily admit that the artistic excellence of the artists I favor is no greater than that of the ones who leave me cold. It is not just credit that I give the ones who are my favorites, it is also a kind of affection. There is, in other words, an emotional aspect to the attitudes many of us have towards our favorite authors, composers, and filmmakers. In some people, it fuels an interest in the biographies of these artists. In others, like me as it happens, it explains a reluctance to learn about the rest of the artist's life for fear of spoiling or complicating the image that supports one's positive feelings. There are fan clubs, or more formally named societies, for artists ranging from Smokey Robinson to Chopin, from A.A. Milne to Dante. And I suspect that most of the members of such organizations would describe their attitudes to their subjects in warmly personal terms. These attitudes seem to me of a piece with the sorts of attitudes P.F. Strawson discusses in Freedom and Resentment. Wanting to bring out the close connections between our practice of holding people morally responsible for their actions and our tendencies to regard them as appropriate objects of such attitudes as gratitude and resentment, Strawson contrasts these reactive attitudes with the objective attitude. And here is that long quote that I already read to you once. To adopt the objective attitude to another human being, Strawson writes, is to see him perhaps as an object of social policy, as something certainly to be taken account, perhaps precautionary account of, to be managed or handled or cured or trained, perhaps simply to be avoided, though this gerund is not peculiar to cases of objectivity of attitude. The objective attitude, he continues, may be emotionally toned in many ways, but not in all ways. It may include repulsion or fear. It may include pity or even love, though not all kinds of love. But it cannot include the range of reactive feelings and attitudes which belong to involvement or participation with others in interpersonal human relationships. It cannot include resentment, gratitude, forgiveness, anger, or the sort of love which two adults can sometimes be said to feel reciprocally for each other. As Strawson notes, we can take the objective attitude towards any individual, at least for a limited time. But there are some individuals and some kinds of individuals about whom we think that only the objective attitude is appropriate. Lower animals, at least significantly lower animals, young children, at least very young children, and machines, at least present-day machines, presumably belong to that category, as do adult human beings with certain severe forms of mental illness or incapacity. Strawson's focus, like that of most philosophers who write on freedom and responsibility, is on moral responsibility and on the moral or near-moral attitudes that are reactions to the good or ill will one person exhibits towards another. But insofar as he includes the sort of love which two adults can sometimes be said to feel reciprocally for each other in his list of reactive attitudes, he suggests that the moral and near-moral attitudes are part of a larger set. For the basis for such love is hardly limited to the degree to which the parties show goodwill to each other. Whom we love and how our loving relationships go may have as much to do with the individual's senses of humor, their responses to nature, or their political engagement. It seems to me that the attitudes of love, affection, or alternatively of chilliness or distaste that one might have toward an artist on the basis of her artwork falls into this broader range. Indeed, it seems easy to imagine a person literally falling in love with a poet or painter on the basis of her poetry or painting, and to see how an already established loving relationship can suffer as a result of how one responds to the other's art. In any case, it seems that the tendency to form attitudes of affection or distaste towards an artist on the basis of her artwork is premised on assumptions about the kind of creature the artist is in ways significantly similar to the way our paradigmatic reactive attitudes are conditioned. If one learned that a cherished painting had been painted by an elephant, or that a musical composition one admired had been produced by a machine, I suspect that any tendency one had to love the artist would spontaneously disappear. One's attitude towards the artwork would be apt to change too. Insofar as our tendency to resent or feel grateful to another for his actions is indicative of our taking him to be morally responsible then, I suggest that our tendency to feel affection or distaste for an artist on the basis of her artworks is a sign that we take her to be aesthetically responsible as well. Although I hope that my discussion will call up experiences that will be familiar to many of you, some may be skeptical of my interpretation of these phenomena, and others, even if you agree that these experiences reflect a tendency to hold artists aesthetically responsible, may think that the tendency should be discouraged rather than validated. Further, my claim that we have reactive attitudes towards artists on the basis of their artworks will not resonate with everyone. Some will not find in themselves any feelings towards the artists of the works they admire or despise. When they watch a movie or look at a painting or listen to music, they will say, they focus on the artwork and don't give the artist a moment's thought. Though they might have a favorite painter, composer, or director, they take that to mean only that the artist in question is a reliable creator of work they feel confident they will find rewarding. It reflects no deeper or more reactive an attitude towards the artist than one would have towards a bird whose song one finds particularly pleasing, or a car manufacturer whose cars one has been consistently satisfied with. My first response to such a skeptic is to wonder whether our experiences of art can really be as different as our words seem to reflect. For I, too, focus on and get immersed in the experience of the artworks themselves. What attitudes I have towards the artists are, in most contexts, of secondary interest and often go by unnoticed. Nor do I mean to claim that the tendency to form reactive attitudes or even judgments awarding more or less aesthetic credit to artists is universal among art lovers, or that all kinds of art and all individual artworks are equally apt to evoke such attitudes and judgments. Some artworks express a point of view or an emotional experience that one naturally takes to be a reflection, if not an intentional communication, of a person's soul. Other works, either more purely sensual or more purely cerebral, are less likely to be seen as outpourings of a unique human sensibility. Furthermore, different people engage with the arts for different reasons. They look for and receive different kinds of rewards. In speaking of the phenomena that I take to reflect a tendency to see artists as aesthetically responsible, then, I have no wish to make normative, much less universal, judgments about how people should experience art. It's enough for my purposes to bring attention to the fact that many people do respond to art in this way. If the skeptic doesn't find that such experiences in himself, he can consider the reactions of others. It is important to me, however, that such reactions be legitimate, so I need to respond to objections that charge that the tendency to regard artists as aesthetically responsible for their artworks is in some way wrong or misguided. Two sorts of objections seem especially likely, one epistemic, the other aesthetic. The first objection concerns the thought that the judgments and attitudes we form towards artists on the basis of their artworks are frequently based on assumptions that are epistemically unsound. Who has not been tempted to infer from a particularly realistic and insightful novel or film that the events portrayed by the novelist or filmmaker must be partly autobiographical? The author must himself have had a summer home in New England, one thinks, or have an alcoholic parent, or be a gay man. Many of us may also tend to assume that in order for emotions to be effectively conveyed in a piece of music or a poem, they must have been experienced by the artist himself, or even that an actor who convincingly portrays intelligence must be intelligent, or that one who excels in portraying psychologically twisted characters must be somewhat psychologically twisted himself. To the charge of inferring more about the lives and characters of artists from their artworks than is warranted, I plead guilty. I often make unsound leaps from artists' works to their lives and personalities, and I am often, or at least sometimes, proved wrong. But these sorts of judgments and the attitudes they bring with them are not the ones I'm concerned to defend. The judgments and attitudes that constitute attributions of aesthetic responsibility can be, and often are, narrow. They presuppose that the aesthetic qualities of the artwork come from the artist in a way that is more than merely causal, but they need not assume that they show anything more about the artist than that she had it in her psychologically to create this very work. Even this, however, a critic might object, is apt to be an ungrounded assumption. Who knows which aesthetically relevant features an artist put into her work on purpose, as opposed to ones that appear in the work accidentally? Sometimes, it's true, an artist leaves notes or gives an interview that tells us what went through her mind. Sometimes an artist makes clear in a work's title what she thinks the work is about. But often she does not. And when artists do speak about what they take their work to mean, or about what they find aesthetically significant about it, the remarks are often disappointingly vague, pretentious, or full of spiritual gibberish. Moreover, and here the epistemic objection blends into the aesthetic one, why should we care about what the artist put into her work non-accidentally in the first place? Isn't it better to just look or listen to the works themselves to see what we can find in them independently of the artist's intentions? For an artist does not have privileged access or authority over the meaning or the value of her work. The fact that an artist intends her work to express something is no guarantee that the work succeeds in doing so, nor does the fact that an artist does not intend her work to express something mean that it doesn't express it nonetheless. To the charge that our tendency to regard artists as aesthetically responsible for their art encourages us to accept inaccurate images of the artists, we now add the objection that this tendency encourages a regrettable approach to appreciating and understanding art. This second criticism is a form of the intentional fallacy, a critique especially of an approach to literary interpretation given prominence by William Wimsatt and Monroe Beardsley in the 1950s. Though I'm sympathetic with the core of Wimsatt and Beardsley's position, their criticisms are often understood in ways that seem to me unacceptably broad. Specifically, although the fallacy that Wimsatt and Beardsley argue for is literally and eponymously directed at the idea that an artist's intentions are of key importance to a correct understanding of or approach to her work, the objection is frequently, if not typically, interpreted as a rejection of the tendency to connect the meaning and significance of an artwork with the psychology of the artist at all. But what an artist expresses in their work and what they intend to express are two different things. And although I agree with Wimsatt and Beardsley that emphasis on the latter question, that of intention, is usually a bad strategy for the appreciation of art, to utterly dismiss the former question seems to me, with respect to a great deal of art, disastrous. For the fact that an artist did not intend to communicate when, in fact, the art calls up to much of its audience does not imply that what the artwork evokes does not come from the artist in some significant way. We can easily imagine a songwriter saying, "I didn't mean to write a sad song," while simultaneously acknowledging that the sadness that is there is an unintentional manifestation of something in him. In characterizing aesthetic responsibility, I've intentionally described the assumed connection between an artist's psychology and the aesthetic features of her work in vague terms. I've said that it's a condition of holding an artist aesthetically responsible in this way that the features be non-accidental, that when we credit or form a reactive attitude to the artist on the basis of her artwork, we presuppose that it shows something about the artist, namely that the artist had it in her to create this very work. But I deliberately avoided any talk of an artist's intentions, decisions, and choices, or any suggestion that the artist would know, much less be in a position to say, exactly what they were doing aesthetically or why. We're too familiar with artists whose poetry, paintings, or songs were composed when they were on drugs or in dreamlike states, of others who talk about being taken over by their muses, and of the mysteries of the creative process, to expect or assume that all the aesthetic features of a work to which we respond are the result of an artist's intentions. But this does not stop us from crediting the artists with the particular aesthetic vision that is realized in their artworks. To deny that it matters to our understanding and appreciation of art whether an artwork reflects an artist's psychology at all would commit one to the view that it is irrelevant even that an artwork is a product of a human or any other intelligent sensibility. It would imply that it is or should be irrelevant to one's experience of an interestingly shaped piece of stone, whether it was sculpted by a human agent or shaped by the forces of wind and rain. That it is or should be irrelevant to one's experience of a set of words on a page, whether it was composed by a poet or was rather, as some fanciful philosophical essays would have us imagine, the product of a monkey randomly plunking keys on a keyboard. Recalling examples I brought up earlier, it would imply that it shouldn't matter to our experience of a painting whether it was done by a person or an elephant, or to our experience of a piece of music whether it was composed by a human or a machine. At least one influential theorist of art, Clive Bell, advocated this radical doctrine. His extreme doctrine of aesthetic formalism claimed that the only thing of aesthetic significance in the visual arts was significant form, defined as combinations of lines and colors that provoke a distinctive aesthetic emotion. For Bell, the aesthetic qualities of a painting do not even depend on whether the painting is representational. Indeed, Bell goes so far as to say that representation in a painting is at best a distraction. But this is an absurd thing to say of Hopper's Nighthawks, or Fra Angelico's Annunciation, or a late Rembrandt self-portrait. Part of what it is to appreciate these paintings is to recognize the sense of human isolation, of beatific serenity, and of psychological insight, respectively, that is inextricable from seeing these paintings as the evocative representations they are. If it is not literally impossible to see paintings in this way without assuming that they were produced non-accidentally by human beings, it is at least a distraction rather than an aid to appreciation to try to suppress or deny this assumption. If we turn to literature, the idea that the author or poet is irrelevant to literary interpretation is even more obviously outrageous. For the very recognition of the marks on the page or the sounds on the audio tape as words, much less as metaphors and puns, character sketches and plots, presupposes that they are products of a human intelligence, and indeed of a human intelligence equipped with a culturally and historically specific language. At any rate, few aestheticians would go so far as Bell. Even Wimsatt and Beardsley admit that a poem does not come into existence by accident. The words of a poem, they say, come out of a head, not out of a hat. Clarifying the assumptions on which the according of aesthetic responsibility rest should, I believe, put both the epistemic and the aesthetic objection to our tendency to regard artists as aesthetically responsible to rest. The assumption that the aesthetic features of artworks show something about their artists, though falsifiable, seems innocent enough. And if that assumption, along with one's experience of a work, grounds an impulse to credit or feel affection or distaste for its artist, so be it. Still, those who don't find such a tendency in themselves might continue to feel uncomfortable, suspicious that those who do have such a tendency are likely to come to art for the wrong reasons and to experience art in a less than optimal way. Again, let me emphasize that I have no wish to make any normative claims about the appreciation of art. I don't mean to suggest that people ought to regard artists as aesthetically responsible, much less that the point of all art is to give you insight into the artist's soul or to put you in a relationship with him, giving you results that would be more efficiently and straightforwardly achieved by reading the artist's autobiography or just taking him to lunch. There are too many different kinds of art and too many different kinds of rewards afforded by art for any such universal normative claims to be plausible. In defending the tendency to regard artists as aesthetically responsible for their art, then, I don't mean to propose that we should be exhibiting more of it. It's rather just that for many consumers of art, including myself, we just do automatically and spontaneously regard artists this way. We cannot help but experience much art as the non-accidental product of an intelligent artist, sometimes as a reflection of the artist's soul, or as an expression of the artist's point of view, or of her distinctive aesthetic vision. If we particularly admire or even love the work of art, we may naturally find ourselves crediting and feeling grateful to the artist. At the least, I've argued, such responses are typically unobjectionable, but for large categories of art, they are more than that. Tolstoy, in his treatise on aesthetics, wrote that every work of art causes the receiver to enter into a certain kind of relationship, both with him who produced or is producing the art and with all those who simultaneously, previously, or subsequently receive the same artistic impression. Speech, transmitting the thoughts and experiences of men, serve as a means of union among them, and art acts in a similar manner. The peculiarity of this latter means of intercourse, distinguishing it from intercourse by means of words, consists in this, that whereas by words a man transmits his thoughts to another, by means of art he transmits his feelings. Although Tolstoy overgeneralized and overmoralized in offering this claim as a universal norm, the continued appeal and popularity of his theory of art testifies to the fact that the kind of glimpse into another's heart and soul, and the communion with the artists as well as with other similarly responding appreciators of art, are among the deepest and most common rewards art has to offer. Another immensely important benefit of art is its ability to expand our knowledge and understanding of the range of human character and sensibility our world contains. Both such rewards are premised on the assumption that art is a reflection of what the artist feels, sees, and thinks. Both such rewards thus rely on the assumption that, in the sense I've been meaning to point out, artists are commonly aesthetically responsible for the aesthetic features of their artworks. But should we really refer to the phenomena I've been discussing as involving a kind of responsibility? Although the term seems natural when introduced in some contexts, it may seem out of place or misleading in others. The word comes easily when contrasting the relationship of an artist to a canvas he painted with his relationship to one in which he clumsily knocked over some cans of paint, or when explaining the shift in our attitudes when we discovered that the artist of a strikingly colored painting was colorblind, or that the writer of an evocative string of words doesn't speak the language of the words he wrote down. There's an enormous difference between learning that an aesthetically interesting object, a visual or tactile form, or a series of words, or a set of musical notes, was painted or written or composed by a conscious human being, and learning that it came about by someone slipping on some paint, or copying words from a dictionary, or plunking random keys on a keyboard. And this difference affects our attitudes and judgments about both the object and its creator. It does not seem unnatural to express this difference by saying that in the first case, but not the second, we find the creator or artist responsible for the aesthetic features of her creation. And to say this is to suggest that there is a difference between merely causal responsibility and another kind, which is deeper. But the patterns according to which we form and withdraw attitudes and judgments towards artists on the basis of their artworks are in some ways quite different from those that characterize our practices of according moral responsibility. And when we focus on the differences, we may find the idea that artists are aesthetically responsible for the qualities in their art that express something in their psychologies more confusing than helpful. In particular, it's commonly thought that whether a person is morally responsible for something he's done depends on whether he could have done otherwise, on whether he had control of his behavior, or on whether he knew what he was doing. If a person is morally responsible, it has been said, he should be able to explain or justify his behavior. It is at the least appropriate to ask him to do so. He's answerable for what he has done. As I pointed out a few minutes ago, however, we apply no such conditions in cases of aesthetic responsibility. We don't expect Shakespeare or Cézanne or Mozart to be able to explain their choices of words, lines, and notes. And the question of whether they could have done otherwise, written different plays, painted different paintings, composed different symphonies, seems utterly beside the point in determining what attitudes we have to these attitudes, to these artists on the basis of their art. Focusing on these contrasts may make us think that the attitudes we form towards artists on the basis of their artwork, even the attitudes of credit, are not really manifestations of a belief in anything properly called responsibility. We admire Shakespeare, certainly, for his richly insightful, clever, and moving plays. But it sounds odd to say that we hold him responsible for these works. In part, I believe the oddness reflects the fact that both in philosophy and in many other contexts, we assume that when we are not using the word responsible to make a merely causal claim, responsibility just means moral responsibility, and our attitudes and judgments about Shakespeare have little to do with morality. It would beg the question to use this as a basis for rejecting the idea of aesthetic responsibility, however, for that idea is meant to challenge the assumption, not to ignore it. There is, however, another basis for the discomfort we might feel in using responsibility in aesthetic contexts that is more philosophically illuminating. This has to do with the strength of the connection between responsibility and control. It's a standard assumption that a person is only responsible for events and states of affairs that are under their control, or relatedly, that a person is only responsible for doing something if they could have done otherwise. Control, in turn, is closely associated with what is within the sphere of a person's will, with what she does or is able to do intentionally, knowing what she is doing. She couldn't help it, he didn't mean it, are standardly taken to be excuses that exempt or mitigate a person's liability to blame. The fact that these features of artists' relation to their artwork play so minor a role in the attitudes we form towards them on the basis of their art may suggest that these attitudes are not indications of attributions of responsibility at all. To be sure, the common tendency to associate responsibility with control is strongest when considering cases in which being responsible would open one to blame and censure. It is thought, reasonably, that it would be unfair to blame someone for something he cannot avoid. And since blame and censure are typically, if not exclusively, appropriate when someone has done something morally bad or wrong, this issue is not wholly independent of the common identification of deep, or at any rate, non-causal responsibility with moral responsibility. Still, the issue is distinct, as can be seen by noticing that debates about the relevance of control can be found within the philosophical literature on moral responsibility itself. Although it's standardly assumed that one should not be held responsible for what is not under one's control, the assumption is not universal. To some, the fact that, due to a person's upbringing, say, he cannot help being racist or a spoiled brat, is not enough to get him off blame's hook. Those familiar with the philosophical literature on responsibility may have heard of the distinction introduced by Gary Watson in Two Faces of Responsibility between two aspects or senses of responsibility, both different from and deeper than causal responsibility, that Watson called attributability and accountability. According to Watson, when we say X is responsible for Y, we sometimes mean to attribute Y to X, in the sense that we take Y to show something about X, to be disclosive of X's self. In other instances, Watson reminds us, we use the expression to say that X may properly be held accountable for Y. If Y is bad, this would justify our blaming X or punishing him or expecting him to explain, apologize, or compensate the victims for Y's effects. The idea that an individual must be in control of something in order for him to be responsible for it makes a lot of sense if one is thinking of responsibility as accountability, but not perhaps in connection with attributability. The question of whether we should think of responsibility as actually having these two faces rather than one or three or even more is a matter of some debate. I shall discuss this distinction at more length in Lecture 4. I mention it here because it may be useful in helping us understand the ambivalence or confusion some might have towards the idea of aesthetic responsibility. For once the distinction is articulated, it seems clear that what I've been calling aesthetic responsibility is a species of attributability. Indeed, as I've been using this phrase, to say that an artist is aesthetically responsible for her art is simply to say that the work can be attributed to her in a deeper or stronger than a merely causal sense, that it has a stronger and more personal connection to her than a mere causal connection would imply, that it comes from her and says something about her, that it is disclosive of herself. It's relatively unimportant whether one wants to use the word responsibility to refer to this connection, though, unfortunately, to substitute talk of attributability here would bring problems of its own. One problem is that the word is so vague and colorless that it gives no indication of a difference between attributing something to an individual and simply predicating it of her. And mere predication is much too broad to capture what is intended by the term. The other is that, in the domain of art in particular, attribution already has a fixed and different meaning. In any case, I believe that our ambivalence and confusion about how to refer to and think about the phenomena that manifests what I've been calling aesthetic responsibility shows us something about both the concepts of responsibility and attributability that philosophers discuss, and about the relation of these concepts to our lives and self-understanding. Let me conclude by pointing out some of the lessons that I think can be learned from these reflections. One lesson that can be learned or reinforced is that the concept of deep and not merely causal responsibility is not as clear or as clean as many people take or want it to be. There are some contexts in which the term seems apt in thinking about the relation between artists and their artworks, and other contexts in which it seems inappropriate, even though one's referring to the very same relation. As I've mentioned, one way philosophers deal with this distinguishes different senses of responsibility, including at least responsibility as attributability and responsibility as accountability. But attributability itself, if it's meant to refer to a substantial and interesting relation between individuals and their actions, properties, and effects, is far from well understood. Earlier, following Watson, I characterized it as having to do with a disclosure or reflection of a self. Something is attributable to an individual insofar as it proceeds from or expresses herself. But what is a self? On what basis do we or should we regard beings as having or being selves, as opposed to just being creatures or objects of other sorts? Can a robot be or have a self? What about a chicken, an infant, a two-year-old? And on what basis do we or should we decide what is part of someone's self and what is alien to it? Strawson's discussion of the contrast between reactive attitudes and the objective attitude, mentioned earlier in the talk, is suggestive in this context. For there's something plausible in the idea that the only kinds of creatures to whom we find it reasonable to robustly attribute things, that is, the only kinds of beings that we can think of as having sufficiently complex, intelligent, and sensitive selves, are the ones to whom we find it appropriate to have reactive attitudes. Moreover, this thought seems equally plausible with respect to aesthetic cases as it does in connection with moral ones. We don't have reactive attitudes to elephant painters, to typing monkeys, or to finger painting toddlers, but we do, or at least we may, to Jackson Pollock and Virginia Woolf. Remembering that Strawson also connects the appropriateness of the reactive attitudes with the potential for involvement or participation with others in interpersonal human relationships suggests the task of understanding what it is to be or to have a self is closely related to the task of understanding what it is to be distinctly human. It is perhaps with respect to this topic that attention to the phenomena I've been discussing can be most philosophically useful as a corrective to an unduly narrow identification of humanity with rational agency that has dominated philosophical thought. When we ask what it takes to be human, understanding this as a broadly ethical rather than a scientific and biological question, the first thing that leaps out tends to be our intelligence, which we have to a higher degree than any other creatures with whom we are acquainted. Historically, we've tended to identify intelligence with the capacity to reason, the ability to think abstractly, and the ability to use language. These in turn have led to our ability to justify our beliefs and actions to ourselves and to others, and our abilities to act in accordance with laws we give to ourselves and with values we endorse. No doubt these abilities play a large role in what makes us especially interesting and important to each other. They are essential to our ability to engage in scientific inquiry and to our ability to be moral agents. But our experience of art, at least the experience of some of us, to the experience of some art, as well as the urge to make art, which I've barely talked about in this talk, also suggest or point to features that make us especially interesting and important to each other. And it's interesting to note that when we ask ourselves what kinds of individuals might be capable of what I've been calling aesthetic responsibility, we're unlikely to focus on the same traits and capacities or identify the same range of creatures. It seems possible to imagine rational creatures, perhaps extraterrestrials or very advanced machines, who lack the capacity to create or appreciate anything we can recognize as art, and to imagine, if not actually find, individuals who do create significant art, even though they lack the deliberative powers and control that would be needed to regard them as fully morally responsible agents. The importance of art in people's lives, both the drive to create it and the passion to experience it, is a remarkable fact of human life, universal across place and time and culture. Arguably, it is as much a mark of the human as is the use of language. Presumably, part of why art moves or speaks to us so strongly is that through art, we can discover and make contact with the emotions, experiences, thoughts, and perspectives of other human souls. Thinking about what it takes to create art that we respond to in this way, as opposed to what might fortuitously bring about an interesting or appealing array of words, sounds, or shapes, and also perhaps what it takes to be responsive to the art of others, can thus provide clues to what it is to be human, of what it is to be a self or a soul like us, that are different from what one gets when one thinks about what it takes for someone to be able to engage in moral deliberation. Thinking along these lines, then, is apt to highlight a somewhat different set of faculties, abilities, and sensitivities from those we notice when we take the paradigm of human activity to be deliberative, rational action. And so, insofar as we cherish those qualities that make us capable of aesthetic responsibility as well as moral responsibility, and those faculties that drive us to create art as well as science, it's important that we not neglect these qualities and faculties in our educational practices, our social policies, or our philosophical theories about what it is to be human.